Anjana. Ramanat Ramanashayi. Haya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Nadati Swapadantikam Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyadevacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 5, Chapter 24, I guess, the first verse. Well, the first new chapter. So I guess we're supposed to read the introduction. Okay, so I'm going to read the introduction to the chapter. The chapter is entitled The Subterranean Heavenly Planets. Srila Prabhupada's introduction here. This chapter describes the planet Rahu, which is 10,000 yojanas, 80,000 miles, below the sun. And it also describes Atala and the other lower planetary systems. Just in case any of us are interested in going to lower planetary systems, then here's some information about them. Rahu is situated below the sun and moon. It is between these two planets and the earth. When Rahu conceals the sun and moon, eclipses occur, either total or partial, depending on whether Rahu moves in a straight or curving way. Below Rahu, by another 1,000,000 yojanas, so times that by 8, so that's what? 8,000,000 miles below Rahu, are the planets of Siddhas, Charanas, and Vidyadharas, and below these are planets such as Yakshaloka and Rakshaloka. Below these planets is the earth, and 70,000 yojanas below the earth are the lower planetary systems, Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Talatala, Mahatala, Rasatala, and Patala. Demons and Rakshasas live in these lower planetary systems with their wives and children, always engaged in sense gratification, and not fearing their next birth. So it sounds very similar to Earth planet and Kali Yuga, isn't it? The sunshine does not reach these planets, but they are illuminated by jewels fixed upon the hoods of snakes. Because of these shining gems, there is practically no darkness. Those living in these planets do not become old or diseased, and they are not afraid of death from any cause but the time factor, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Of course, this is not in all the lower planetary systems, but in the ones that are lower but closer to the Earth planet, they're like heavenly planets, practically, except there's no sun. In the planet Attila, the yoni of a demon has produced three kinds of women called Swairini, independent, Kaimini, lusty, and Pumshchali, very, very easily subdued by men. Below Attila is the planet Vitala, wherein Lord Shiva and his wife Gauri reside. Because of their presence, a kind of gold is produced called Hataka. Below Vitala is the planet Sutala, the abode of Bali Maharaj, the most fortunate king. Bali Maharaj was favored by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vamandev, because of his intense devotional service. The Lord went to the sacrificial arena of Bali Maharaj and begged him for 3 paces of land. And on this plea, the Lord took from him all his possessions. When Bali Maharaj agreed to all this, the Lord was very pleased, and therefore the Lord serves as his doorkeeper. And this is in Sutala. The description of Bali Maharaj appears in the 8th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead offers a devotee material happiness, this is not his real favor. Of course, the Christians might disagree with us, but this is the Bhagavatam's idea. The demigods, who are very puffed up by their material opulence, pray to the Lord only for material happiness, not knowing anything better. Devotees like Prahlad Maharaj, however, do not want material happiness. Not to speak of material happiness, they do not want even liberation from material bondage. Although one can achieve this liberation simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord, even with improper pronunciation or improper concentration, like us in Japa time. Below Sutala is the planet Talatala, the abode of the demon Maya. Maya Dhanava. This demon is always materially happy because he is favored by Lord Shiva, but he cannot achieve spiritual happiness at any time. Below Talatala is the planet Mahatala, where there are many snakes with hundreds and thousands of hoods. Below Mahatala is Rasatala, and below that is Patala, where the serpent Vasuki lives with his associates. That ends the introduction. Any questions? Anyone wants to ask anything?
In the highest lower planetary system, there's no disease or old age. Lord Shiva is living there. Bali Maharaj is living there. So I guess my conception of the lower planetary system was maybe misconceived or something, because I thought it's all... Yes. How do we understand this?
Maybe it was misconceived. Maybe I think here the lower planetary systems are different from hell. Because when we think lower planetary systems, we just assumed hell. But actually, it looks like they're actually like it's a lower heavenly region, basically. And hell is coming up next in 2 chapters. It's below the Earth planet. So the categorization is in terms of above the Earth planet or below the Earth planet. That's what we just now heard. And perhaps what we can appreciate is that the lines between piety and impiety become somewhat blurred by hearing this description. Normally we think piety, you go up and you enjoy, and impiety, you go down and you suffer. But from this type of description, it becomes a little bit more nuanced. The difference between piety and impiety becomes blurred. Of course, this is from the relative position of conditioned life. From the absolute position, it's all stool. So what's the difference between wet stool and dry stool? Right? Only person who makes a distinguishes between wet stool and dry stool is a pig. Right? For a human being, it's all stool. So similarly, material happiness on a higher planetary system or a lower planetary system is all stool. And the only way that we could appreciate it differently is because of false ego. You know, this is better than that. So it's by the influence of false ego that we actually distinguish one thing or another. Or you could say the mind and senses, the subtle body. By the influence of the subtle body, we distinguish between all these things. Just like it appears that we all have the same senses, right? Eyes, ears, nose. But we all are attracted to very different types of sense gratification. The senses are actually not attracted in the same way. Although the senses are essentially the same thing, but we're not attracted in the same way. Why is that? That's because of the influence of the subtle body. What is that Krishna says in chapter 15, Bhagavad Gita? 15:9. Anyone knows? Anyone has a computer? A phone? 15:9. Krishna says that the senses are grouped about the mind. I don't remember the Sanskrit. It would be nice. So only by the influence of the false ego do our senses perceive a different reality and appreciate it differently. But from an enlightened perspective, it's all just the same five elements, augmented together to create the apparent variety, but it's just the same thing. There's no difference. For the enlightened soul, for the conditioned soul, we distinguish between wet stool and dry stool due to the influence of the subtle body. Does it make sense? So like this, by this description, we can appreciate that really, the lines between piety and piety are somewhat rather blurred, actually. And as is everything in the material world, nothing is absolute, absolutely anything, because it's not the absolute realm. So nothing is absolute in the relative realm. Just like the motive goodness, motive passion, we normally speak motive goodness good, motive passionate, ignorance bad. But that's not absolutely true. Because the modes, for example, if you have to be creative, the motive passion is very good. If you need to get something done, motive passion is actually required. And now if you're trying to sleep, motive ignorance is important at that time. Suppose you're trying to sleep and everyone is having like a party in your room or something like that, you know, and they're like heavy motive passion. You need to help in the motive ignorance to actually sleep and recharge the body and so on. So the material world, the modes of nature, not absolutely anything actually. It really depends on context. Just like, for example, another example of motor ignorance being used. So if you have to destroy something to build something new, the act of destruction is a motor ignorance, but we don't say it's bad. Just like we wanted to build a new property at the firehouse station, if we got it, or if we would get it. Then you destroy it. That's not considered a bad thing, because you want to build something wonderful on top of that foundation. But the act of destruction is the motor ignorance, and the act of creating something is the motor passion. So nothing is absolutely anything in the material world. It really depends on perspective. And because the devotee's perspective is that it's all stool, so there's no difference. He doesn't make any difference between even piety and impiety and so on. Of course, he may act in a pious way in order to, for an example, for conditioned souls who need to act piously in order to help unlock their consciousness from asat. But otherwise, once you get liberated, it's all just stool in one sense. Or Krishna's energy, you know, you can say it in a positive way. It's all just Krishna's energy. Stool. Yeah.
Ones. And so I guess then there's earth, and then there's maybe six above.
Yeah.
And then below all of that, there's the hellish planetary systems.
Yeah, I think Dayata would be more fit for a discussion on the geography of the universe, because he looks into like Sariputta's things and so on. This chapter is dealing with the geography of the lower planetary systems. And once I get started, I'm just going to read verses, nothing for me to really discuss. There are some relevant points for the consciousness that Prabhupada pulls up in some of the purports. But what it looks like, I'm understanding, it seems like there's a lower planetary system and then there's hell. That's what it sounds like. Otherwise, there would be no need to give it a separate chapter. You know, the subterranean is even described, the subterranean heavenly planets. And then there's a chapter for the hellish planets. So it appears there's a distinction between the two. Although normally we just thought lower planetary systems meant hell. But actually the whole material existence means hell. Right? That's what Ishvapanishad says, right? What is the language of the Ishvapanishad? By not understanding the difference between Asats and Asat, then you take birth in the planets, the darkest regions of the universe, right? And then Prabhupada's purport describes what? That the darkest regions of the universe means the whole universe, because the whole universe is dark and requires the assistance of sun and moon for illumination. So the darkest region of the universe refers to the whole universe, which is the whole Brahmanda, actually. So only, again, by the influence of false ego, we say lower planetary systems is bad, upper planetary systems is good. But from the enlightened perspective, it's either all hell or a more enlightened perspective. That's like the Gani's enlightened perspective. It's all hell, asat. So he has an intense aversion towards it. And from the devotional enlightened perspective, it's all Krishna's energy. Like that, nothing to be exploited as such. This is better for my sense gratification. He doesn't see it in that way. Like that. So hell looks like a different place. Any other points, questions, discussion? Yeah.
Is this the reason that modern science can't conceive of these material planets because they're below the Earth and within another like planetary region? So like telescopes or whatnot can't conceive of planets that are below
Perhaps. There are many reasons that material scientists or anyone for that matter can conceive of it because it's inconceivable. And ultimately speaking, the description is quite inconceivable. And yes, there's limitations to our ability for understanding things by sense perception. So we have to appreciate that reality. There's a limitation to sensual understanding of reality. For example, I was asking this question to some of the young men in London. What is the reason that there is something instead of nothing? Why is there existence instead of no existence? Now, outside of a theistic concept, how would you answer that question? Outside of a theistic paradigm, theistic meaning you accept that there's God, how would this question be answered? Why is there an existence instead of no existence? It's very hard. You can actually say there's a limitation to what the senses are empirically able to ascertain, like this type of question. You know, in fact, this is the type of question that they ask in physics. I read about it. That's how it came to my mind, in fact. And they don't have an answer for this type of question. So Exactly. What happens is that because you can't actually understand these types of questions by the material senses, then basically you understand it in terms of your faith or your worldview, which can now also be empirically proved. You have to make sense of it all by a type of belief, so to speak. Otherwise, there's no other way to make sense of it whatsoever. By just empiricism alone, you can't make sense of it. So you know why there is existence instead of no existence, and then subsequently, why the variety in the existence. Of course, modern science can explain things like evolution when dealing with the Earth planet, but when you deal with the whole cosmos, you know, why this whole variety and why the nature of that variety? Why does it have this nature instead of that nature? Like, why does fire burn instead of cool? So there's a limitation to essential perception of anything. So also the lower planetary systems and so on. So someone would say, because I have not seen the lower planetary systems or hell, then I do not believe in it. That is okay, but that doesn't mean you don't have to go. You might still have to go, whether you believe it or not. Just like you say, I don't believe in the government, that's okay. But if you break the law, you're still going to go to prison. So we, at least in most theistic traditions, we accept that it is best to learn by the hearing process, by shabda, by authority. So they're speaking about these things. So sometimes they say, well, sometimes like atheists, they will compare God to the tooth fairy. They say, I can't empirically prove that there's no tooth fairy. Therefore, I don't believe in the tooth fairy. So similarly, we cannot empirically prove that there's no God, but why should we believe? But who's talking about tooth fairies? You don't hear people talking about tooth fairies and so on. You hear people talking about God, though, historically throughout the, not only throughout the world, there's some type of theistic concept of existence. And you don't hear people talking about a fairy tooth concept of existence. So it's a false argument. It's a false argument in order to bewilder the mind of people who are simple and can understand, are easily deceived by, or easily beguiled by these specious arguments like that, right? So then the point is we should appreciate that there is limitation to our sensual jurisdiction and therefore learn from authority. That's kind of the point. So authority is talking about the lower planetary systems and hell. So we accept there is a hell. There is a way to go there by being very sinful and so on. Anything else? Okay, so I'll start some of the reading process here. Let's see how far we'll go. This is verse 1. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, "My dear King, some historians, the speakers of the Puranas, say that 10,000 yojanas, 80,000 miles, below the sun is a planet known as Rahu, which moves like one of the stars. The presiding deity of that planet, who is the son of Simhika, is the most abominable of all asuras. But although he is completely unfit to assume the position of a demigod or planetary deity, he has achieved that position by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Later I shall speak further about him." So even though he's completely abominable, he's gotten some type of high position by the grace of the Personality of Godhead. That's nice. You might take a practical point from that in terms of sometimes you think certain leaders are completely abominable and we allow that to suck up our consciousness. Why are they like this and not some other way? Either it'd be like a temple president. Sometimes devotees think like that. My temple leader is abominable. Maybe they don't use that word in their mind because that's rather offensive, but they don't think positively about their leaders. Or like our governments in the Kali Yuga and so on, we may tend to think, and then we allow that to suck up our consciousness in that way. We're always looking for articles for their abominable activities and so on. But then we can understand they gain such position by the grace of the Personality of Godhead. People are, you know, nothing is uncontrolled in this world. Everything is happening by divine arrangement, ultimately. So in this way, a devotee will stay peaceful. So the Personality of God has made this arrangement. Just like I was just hearing 2 days ago, some devotee was telling me that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was telling me this? You, maybe? Someone was telling me this. I think Ananta Vasudev, that was you. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's, one of his preeminent disciple. He had, when he first met Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, and I think Gaurakishore Das Babaji, they were all in the room chanting japa. And I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur, was it? He remarked that we actually like the British because they don't disturb our chanting of Harinam. So he saw the subjugation of the British as a very positive thing. We actually like them because they don't disturb our Harinam. Like that. Next verse. The sun glow, which is a source of heat, extends for 10,000 yojanas, 80,000 miles. The moon extends for 20,000 yojanas, 160,000 miles. And Rahu extends for 30 yojanas, 240,000 miles. Formerly, when nectar was being distributed, Rahu tried to create dissension between the sun and moon by interposing himself between them. Rahu is inimical toward both the sun and the moon, and therefore he always tries to cover the sunshine and moonshine on the dark moon day and full moon night. Purport. As stated herein, the sun extends for 10,000 yojanas and the moon extends for twice that, or 20,000 yojanas. The word dwadasha should be understood to mean twice as much as 10 or 20. In the opinion of Vijayadwaja, the extent of Rahu should be twice that of the moon, or 40,000 yojanas. However, to reconcile this apparent contradiction to the text of the Bhagavatam, Vijayadwaja cites the following quotation concerning Rahu. Rahu somo ravinam tu mandala dwi gunoktitam. This means that Rahu is twice as large as the moon, which is twice as large as the sun. This is the conclusion of the commentator Vijayadwaja. Yeah. I don't know. Did you hear like that anywhere?
No.
Yeah, I also don't know. To be honest with you, I never took interest in the discussion of the geography of the universe. Because I'm like, how the hell is this going to help me get out of the material world? That's usually my mental. Of course, we can't say that it's unimportant because it's in the Bhagavatam. So it has a certain importance to it, obviously. But one that I never took seriously on a personal level. So I don't know all the details. That's why I said I'm not the best person to give a discussion on the geography of the universe. It would have been nice if we could have had a PowerPoint and see, you know, those of us who like sightseeing. It's like sometimes devotees come to Chicago and they want us to take them around the city. And I tell them, well, Krishna doesn't recommend sightseeing in the Bhagavad Gita. So how do you find such an instruction in the Bhagavad Gita? Where does Krishna say that he doesn't recommend sightseeing? And I quote the verse, A Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punara Vachana. From the topmost planet down the lowest, all are places of misery. In other words, there's nothing to see but misery. And therefore, our devotee doesn't take interest in such affairs. So therefore, there's nothing like sightseeing going on. But oftentimes, they want to go and see the Sears Tower and see the downtown. And it's the same sense gratification you can see anywhere going on. Anyway, I don't know so much about this section of the Bhagavatam. Because I never took much interest in, because I thought, just like sometimes for some certain devotees when Prabhupada said we didn't go to the moon, that was very hard for them to digest. But it was like, who the hell cares if we went or not? I always liked Prabhupada's, when he saw many of his disciples were losing faith after reading his fifth canto description, he sometimes would adjust his preaching by not saying that we didn't go to the moon, but by saying that even if we went to the moon, we'll simply fight like cats and dogs there. So what difference does it make? You know, just like some of us played fighting games before we were devotees, or maybe even sometimes now. But there was we played this Mortal Kombat game, or I used to like Mortal Kombat, or Street Fighter, Tekken, and all these types of fighting games. And you can get like a different fighting arena, you know? And Killer Instinct, I remember especially, had these different, like, cool fighting arenas. So, like, that's what's going on in the material world. So, you know, like, the Earth arena, so you can go to the moon and fight, you know, or go to Mars. There's, just, like, different fighting arenas. Because as long as we're not Krishna conscious, then that's what goes on. We fight like cats and dogs. So I always appreciated that particular method of Prabhupada's preaching also. That, what difference does it make? Anyway, even if we win, we'll simply fight there also. The real point is that we have to become Krishna conscious. Just like Prahlad Maharaj praised this verse, Yasmat priya priya vyoga sam yoga janma shokagnina sakala yoni shudhahyamana dugoshadam tarapitu kamatadiyaham bhumam brahmami varametava dasa yogam. He says the living entities in the material world, sakala yoni shu, all of them, the demigods, the reptiles, the mammals, the humans, all of them, sakala yoni shu means all of them, they are always, their hearts are always burning in a fire of lamentation. Dahyamana shoka agnina, burning in the fire of lamentation. Why? Yasma priya priya vyoga samyoga janma. Because they're priya means that which is dear to them. Vyoga, that which is dear to them, they're being separated from that. Isn't it? That causes great lamentation. Something dear to you, like a very dear sense object, like the object of sex desire or family members or something. They're something that's very dear to you or a job or whatever. And you're being separated from that. And that which is apriya, that which is not dear to you, you're being samyoga. You're being connected to that, brought together with that. So as a result of this experience in the material world, our hearts are always burning in the fire of lamentation. Dugoshadam tadapi dukam. So then Prahlad Maharaj says that we try to find a oshadam, means a remedy for this situation. But that remedy oftentimes tends to augment or make the problem even more acute than the original problem. So atadiyaham, and that's because we haven't, our approach to the situation is still from the Bali concept of life. And therefore, bhumam brahmami vadameta vadasyogam. So therefore, my dear Lord, for all the living entities who are wandering this brahmanda, I ask you to instruct me on the dasya yogam, your dasya yogam, tava dasya yogam. I ask you to instruct me about your bhakti yoga, about devotion to you, because this is actually a real solution to the issue. So therefore, these types of sections have their value in terms of helping us to see that it's all really a sat going on in the material world. It's all temporary. And like I said, because this section kind of blurs the lines between the results of piety and piety and so on, then it's like, yeah, there's nothing going on in the material world. Let's go to Krishna. So perhaps, for me, it gives that type of understanding. It's something I can take from my consciousness. Otherwise, it's just like, you know, it's like hearing about Fiji Island or something. You know, in the Fiji Island, it was this, and it was that, and it was that. And how many of you would be interested in hearing about that? My ears are popping. That's why you see me keep playing with my ear. Anyone here interested in hearing about the Fiji Islands? No? Hawaii? Bahamas? No? Why not? Because I don't have any money, huh? I can't enjoy it, so what's the point of hearing about it? Only agitating the heart. That's one reason. And the other reason is all temporary. What difference does it make going here or there? It's all the same, basically. Especially in the modern situation where it used to be attractive to me when I was a youth to travel, because I thought I would experience a different culture by going to different places. But by traveling, you realize that you're experiencing the same culture everywhere. Everywhere there's a KFC, there's a, you know, a McDonald's, there's a Subway. You know, everywhere you go, it's the same thing you find in Belmont and Clark, you find in other places. It's not like a unique culture anymore, practically speaking. So, similarly. But anyway, we have to hear about it for our purification. So let us continue the purification. Next verse. After hearing from the sun and moon, demigods, about Rahu's attack, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, engages his disc known as the Sudarshan Chakra to protect them. The Sudarshan Chakra is the Lord's most beloved devotee and is favored by the Lord. The intense heat of its effulgence meant for killing non-Vaishnavas is unbearable to Rahu, and he therefore flees in fear of it. During the time Rahu disturbs the sun or moon, there occurs what people commonly know as an eclipse. Now, obviously, you shouldn't share this to newcomers in the academia. Note to self. Our Acharya Nisha Prabhu was asked a question at the university program about our conception of the universe. So, feeling inspired by the super soul, I guess, he started to describe, well, first there's Mahavishnu, and when he breathes out of all his pores come the universes. And then he enters into the universes as Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, and then a lotus flower comes out of his navel. And born on that lotus flower is a four-headed creature named Brahma. And then he assembles, now, so one new girl had come to the program that day. So when she heard this description, she filed a complaint to the school that these people are a cult. and they're trying to brainwash people, but they bring Bhakti Shan, because Bhakti Shan used to be a student at the school. They bring Shan to show us what we should be like in the future. And they speak all sorts of nonsense, you know, like this, that, and other. He got in trouble. So obviously you have to show a little discretion. These types of descriptions obviously have to be understood by faith, as is all descriptions of the universe. Even the way people understand the universe now is by faith primarily, because it's not like they're looking through the telescopes and understanding these things. They just take it for granted that whatever they're hearing from the scientists is true. So also we're doing the same thing, but we're using our authorities instead of their authorities. So it's essentially the same thing. But because theism is not on the rise, but atheism is on the rise, then when they hear that we think that God is actually the efficient cause of the universe, then it is taken as a sort of fanaticism. So we might have to show discretion in revealing some of these descriptions. But for us, it's nice purification to hear about the universe. So this is Prabhupada's purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, is always a protector of his devotees, who are also known as demigods. The controlling demigods are most obedient to Lord Vishnu, although they also want material sense enjoyment, and that is why they are called demigods or almost godly. That's an interesting point. Although Rahu attempts to attack both the sun and the moon, they are protected by Lord Vishnu. Being very afraid of Lord Vishnu's chakra, Rahu cannot stay in front of the sun or moon for more than a muhurta, 48 minutes. The phenomenon that occurs when Rahu blocks the light of the sun or moon is called an eclipse. The attempt of the scientists of the earth to go to the moon is as demoniac as Rahu's attack. Just throw that in there. Of course, their attempts will be failures because no one can enter the moon or sun so easily. Like the attack of Rahu, such attempts will certainly be failures. Next verse. Below Rahu, by 10,000 yojanas, 80,000 miles, are the planets known as Siddhaloka, Charana Loka, and Vidyadhara Loka. So these planets are all above the Earth planet that we're hearing about now. Rahu and these planets, Siddhaloka, etc. Purport. It is said that the residents of Siddhaloka, being naturally endowed with the powers of yogis, can go from one planet to another by their natural mystic powers without using airplanes or similar machines. Siddhaloka is a planet where yogis live with all the perfected mystic opulences, which are 18 in number, but 8 are prominent yoga siddhis. Anyone here desire siddhis, mystic opulences? Would be nice, right? That's why we don't have them. Next verse. Beneath Vidyadhara Loka, Charana Loka, and Siddha Loka, in the sky called Antariksha, are the places of enjoyment for the yakshas, rakshasas, and pishachas, ghosts, and so on. So these are all above the earth planet, these planets for the rakshasas and yakshas and pishachis and so on. So that's interesting, right? We think going up means piety, right? But here some demons live up also. Antariksha extends as far as the wind blows and the clouds float in the sky. Above this, there is no more air. Next verse. Below the abodes of the yakshas and rakshasas by a distance of 100 yojanas, 800 miles, is the planet Earth. Its upper limits extend as high as swans, hawks, eagles, and similar large birds can fly. Okay. Did you get that? Its upper limits of the Earth planet extend as high as swans, hawks, eagles, and similar large birds can fly. Okay. Anyone else want to take a shot also? No? Next verse. My dear king, beneath this earth are seven other planets known as Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Talatala, Mahatala, Rasatala, and Patala. I have already explained the situation of the planetary systems of Earth. The width and length of the seven lower planetary systems are calculated to be exactly the same as those of Earth. In these seven planetary systems, which are also known as the subterranean heavens, Bila Swarga, there are very beautiful houses, gardens, and places of sense enjoyment, which are even more opulent than those in the higher planets, because the demons have a very high standard of sense pleasure. So they don't mess around, you know. That's an interesting point. They have a very high standard of sensual pleasure, wealth, and influence. Most of the residents of these planets, who are known as Daityas, Danavas, and Nagas, live as householders. That's kind of subtly to imply that householder life is demoniac existence. We could probably qualify by saying materialistic householder life, but the idea is that it tends to give a subtle implication that the demons mostly live as householders. They don't live as renunciates. To imply that householder existence is meant for a demonic mentality of sense enjoyment. That's just food for thought, yeah. I'll finish the translation, then you can ask your question. Their wives, children, friends, and society are fully engaged in illusory material happiness. This is what it means to be a demon. So this helps clarify our position. The sense enjoyment of the demigods is sometimes disturbed, but the residents of this planet enjoy life without disturbances. Thus, they are understood to be very attached to illusory happiness. That's interesting. The illusory, in the Swargaloka, the demons are always disturbing them. And also envy and all these things, they come up too in the higher planetary regions. Somehow they don't experience the same in the lower planetary heavenly regions. Yeah, you want to?
I want to ask to clarify, could it be that these householders fall under the Grihamedi program? Because
yes,
most devotees would be considered Grihasta,
theoretically,
householder.
Yes. That's why I said it's good to qualify by saying materialistic householder life. But the idea is that householder life, the tendency is to evolve a demoniac mentality and householder existence. To be a Grihasta is not so easy. As to be anything in this world, is anything good or proper in this world is a great challenge. Because the natural drift of the conditioned soul is towards ignorance. And, you know, so also Grihastha Ashram, it's hard to maintain a profound spiritual standard. I think this is true of all the ashrams in Kali Yuga, but particularly household life, when you have your own facility, you're by yourself, you're alone. Unfortunately, because a lot of our ashrams are also like that, so the same mentality will creep up in the Brahmacharya ashram as well. But the idea is that generally the household situation tends to generate a mentality of increasing sense of enjoyment in the living entity. At first you think I'll be really good about it. You know, I'll get my house and I'll continue to serve and I'll continue to come and like that. But gradually, you know, work takes over and then bills and then social life is there. It's very important to meet social standards, etc. And that way it tends to generate a mentality of sense enjoyment. So, and therefore it's considered to be, in this context, an andokupam, a great well, dark well for which one falls into and never gets out. Like that. Of course, if you're like our grihasthas here that serve, like particularly the ones that serve around the temple, it's easier because they have engagement to the deity like all day. So then there's no chance for them to develop anything but Krishna consciousness. But generally, if you don't have that type of facility, it's very hard to keep the momentum. Because we already want to enjoy, and it's like you have facility for that now. So how to resist is very difficult. It's like if you're flying on the airplane and everyone's looking at a movie and enjoying nicely, then you feel like, okay. Understand? Purport. According to the statements of Prahlad Maharaj, material enjoyment is maya sukha, illusory enjoyment. A Vaishnava is full of anxieties for the deliverance of all living entities from such false enjoyment. Prahlad Maharaj says, maya sukhaya bharam udarato vimudhan. These fools, vimudhas, are engaged in material happiness, which is surely temporary. Rather, in the heavenly planets, the lower planets, or the earthly planets, people are engrossed in temporary material happiness, forgetting that in due course of time they have to change their bodies according to the material laws and suffer the repetition of birth, death, old age, and disease. Not caring what will happen in the next birth, gross materialists are simply busy enjoying the present short span of life. A Vaishnava is always anxious to give all such bewildered materialists the real happiness of spiritual bliss. Right? So that means we also need the context of experiencing spiritual bliss to really distribute it profoundly. That is important. Otherwise, what tends to happen, as it can be observed, what tends to happen is if you're not careful, if you preach without the context of an actual experience of bliss, transcendental bliss, then excessive association with materialistic people, even in the form of preaching, might tend to bring you more to their side before we bring them to their side. For example, like the bridge preaching programs that exist, they are a very wonderful attempt to bring people to Krishna consciousness, and therefore it's glorious. Any attempt to bring people to Krishna consciousness is glorious. But when you lack the context of transcendental bliss, then it becomes dangerous because of excessive association, and also in a way that's not directly Krishna conscious, because they're not ready for that because they're envious. So they want to hear about Krishna yet. You know, Krishna says, I'm speaking to you about my glories because you're not envious of me, right? In Bhagavad Gita, Pravakshami Anusuyave, because I'm speaking to you because you are non-envious. So because we're dealing with envious population, we generally tend to only speak up to the first six chapters of Gita, self-realization, consciousness, like that, because it's easier to digest. But then to hear about Krishna is much difficult. So we may not speak about Krishna directly, but we, by their associating with us and prasadam, and et cetera, kirtan, they'll get purified, and they'll hopefully develop a capacity to hear about Krishna. But when we lack that context of spiritual bliss, then one's own sadhana and all these things have to be very, very strong. Otherwise, you might tend to get pulled in the name of compassion before you pull them out of the ocean of material existence. Understand? So as mentioned here, Prahlad Maharaj has the context of has the contrasting experience of spiritual happiness against the previous experience of aversion to Krishna. And therefore, that contrasting experience, he really knows simultaneously what is actual happiness, and he also knows what the divinities are actually going through, what they're suffering from, as said in the Siddha, you know. And that way, he's the most fit to really help them, because he knows he can really empathize with their plight, unlike the Nitya Siddhas. The Nitya Siddhas don't know what is suffering, and nor does Krishna, because it's intense bliss. What was that? Sharananda? Vishayatma, what is, you all studied this already. Huh? Sundarananda? No. I think it's Shraddhananda. Shraddhananda, not Shraddha, but S-A-R-D-A-N-A-N-D-A. Shraddha, like that. It's not Sundara, means beautiful. Beautiful Ananda, which is also true. It means that it's like compact bliss in the spiritual world. It's like, and the example is given is like dense metal, you know, dense metal, like a crowbar or something. It's so dense that nothing can easily penetrate through it, right? Because it's very dense. So the bliss in the spiritual world is extremely dense. So therefore, nothing like suffering can penetrate it. And therefore, the misery of the conditioned souls cannot also penetrate their heart because the bliss is too intense. This is described by Jiva Goswami. Sundarananda, okay. Isn't this fascinating information? Krishna really can't feel for the jivas directly. Although we hear Krishna's compassionate, but his compassion is really shown towards his devotees who are experiencing the plight of separation from him. And Krishna's mercy towards us is indirect. It's really through his devotees who have attained the contrasting experience of happiness and Krishna consciousness against the black backdrop of their previous aversion towards God. And therefore, Jiva Goswami says, just like waking up from a nightmare, you still have the impression of a nightmare upon waking up. So when the sadhana siddhas attain the spiritual position, siddha, the position of siddhi, then like a nightmare, they can understand the plight of the conditioned souls and therefore feel for them. And so Krishna's mercy follows the mercy of those, particularly in context of sadhana siddhas who are actually feeling for the fallen condition of souls. Otherwise, Krishna himself is directly, because he's a little preoccupied with the gopis and gopas in the spiritual world, to be all concerned about what's going on in the material world. And the suffering also that's going on is also illusory. So it's just like if you see me suffering because I'm watching my favorite basketball player lose a game or something like that, then you're not going to take it very seriously, right? Because it's not a very serious thing to be happy. So similarly, the suffering, the condition of souls, in one sense, is not very serious because it's all illusory. And therefore, nothing to really be taken seriously. So what is taken seriously by Krishna is playing leapfrog with the gopas in the spiritual world. Himanshu gave this language the other day. Krishna's playing leapfrog with the cowherd boys. That's taken very seriously. Playing leapfrog with the cowherd boys and joking around with the gopis. Again, to show discretion in sharing this, you know, with the non-devotees and so on. But that's what's, because that's, so it's intense bliss. So anyway, the point I'm making, probably as a Vaishnava, is always concerned about helping the conditioned souls who are trapped in the Maya Sukha, the happiness of mature Maya. But really, this seems to refer to sadhana siddhas who can really feel for them, and also it also indicates that they really have that transcendental experience by which to contrast the happiness of sense enjoyment against, and thus bring them to the side of spiritual enjoyment. It's like sometimes we're not so convinced that material sense gratification is useless. I mean, we're convinced intellectually, but once material sense gratification is in front of you, then you kind of become unconvinced, isn't it? Yeah, very bewildering. Is it good or bad? You know, theoretically, now, Bhagavad Gita says it's the birth of misery, but look how they're smiling. You know, like I always mention, I'm like a broken record, but I always mention when we're downtown Chicago driving on the lakefront in the summertime, it's like that real nice breeze is coming, the sun is setting, and you see all the couples on the lakefront holding hands and laughing and giggling, and you know, immediately you got to turn your head. Otherwise, if you see too much, wow, maybe Bhagavad Gita is wrong. I know Bhagavad Gita is right, but you know, Bhagavad Gita needs to be a little bit more. It's nuanced, you know. If you do it properly, then like this, you get bewildered. Yes, because the problem is that the living entity, the conditioned soul's will, is very minute, as a jiva is minute. So unless his will is backed by spiritual potency, then he can't resist the magnetism of the material energy, right? It's just like if you take like a small dying coin and you have like this huge magnet, then how will it resist? Is a huge magnet is there and the dime is like this big, you know? It's just whoosh, immediately, isn't it? It's very quickly. Not like a gradual movement, but whoosh, very quickly. So similarly, our will is like that. It's so weak when not backed by spiritual potency that all it takes is Maya doing like a pirouette in front of us. How you doing? You know, big shot. Immediately finished. So our business as sadhaka is that we have to get spiritual backing for our will. And with that spiritual backing, our will will only be used for serving Krishna. Just like in the spiritual world, they have free will as such, or will. Free will is somewhat redundant because to have will means it's free. Otherwise, there's no meaning to the word will as such. But you have free will. So the residents of the spiritual world, they have free will, but it's all backed by Swarup Shakti. So they only use their will for serving Krishna. So it's not like they freely choose to always serve Krishna because their will is backed by spiritual potency. Whereas our will is lacking that backing, and therefore our will can be attracted to so many other varieties in the material nature. So our business as sadhaka is to increase the influence of spiritual potency in our heart, by which our will becomes backed by that potency. And there's no question of material energy. And then when you preach from that context, it's very powerful. At least at the very minimum, you don't run the risk of becoming drowned yourself. That's the bare minimum. At least you can preach without running the risk of becoming drowned. Otherwise, when we preach, which we should do in the assistance of the spiritual master, but we have to make sure that we're really strong on other things also. Otherwise, at any moment, we can become bewildered. Right? Does it make sense? Any question about that? And yeah.
You were mentioning, I was wondering, because we see Nitya Siddhas like Srila Prabhupada, Vasudev Dad, they're feeling immense compassion. So how is that the case?
Yeah, good question. That's all I can say is a good question. Anyway, sometimes it is mentioned, like in the case of Narada Muni and Prahlad Maharaj, that they were both simultaneously Nitya Siddha and Sadhana Siddha. So such a concept is there. I just read that in the seventh canto when I was in India. So there is such a concept as being both Nitya Siddha and Sadhana Siddha. That wasn't explained in great detail, but it was mentioned by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So such a concept is at least there. That could probably perhaps reconcile the idea. Another idea, that's all I can really say on that one. Without speculating further and getting way off the mark. The other idea is that the nature of devotees seems to be compassion, of course, in general. But this is a topic that requires much investigation, so I just gave the information because it's interesting food for thought. and it also helps us understand because many times, many groups, they come to ISKCON and they say that unless the spiritual master is Nitya Siddha, then he's not a bona fide spiritual master. This is a very popular thing that they tell many of our ISKCON devotees who have very weak faith. And so our spiritual master just happens to be a Nitya Siddha, and I happen to be able to recognize that because I'm very advanced, right? That my spiritual master happens to be Nitya Siddha. I'm able to know that because I guess he told them, right?
I'm Nityasiddha or I'm very advanced to be able to understand that. And so then our devotees who have weak faith, they get bewildered, they go to these other groups. But from the Shastras, we actually see that the Sadhana Siddhas seem more equipped in a lot of ways to become emissaries of the Lord's compassion because they have the contrasting experience of being materially conditioned and then being liberated from that. And therefore, they really become the most equipped to feel for the conditioned souls and also to help them come to the spiritual platform. And in the Madhurya Kandambini, you also see this whole discussion about how does the Lord's mercy come to us. This is the whole discussion of the first chapter of the Madhurya Kandambini. And there it is mentioned how is fortune the reason? But it can't be fortune because that means bhakti is dependent on fortune. Is the Lord's causes mercy the reason? Well, if it's causes mercy that people get bhakti, everyone should be getting it, but we don't see that. But what about the devotee's causes mercy? But then that means he's partial, but that is okay. Because in the case of the Madhyam Bhakta, it is seen that he is partial. So when it says the Madhyam Bhakta, it tends to indicate a devotee of not the highest order exactly the highest order. Although the Madhyam Bhakta, he has prema, that's mentioned, he has prema, he has Shuddha Bhakti. But he's not the Uttama Bhagavata, so he may not have that highest level of the emotional content in his heart. But yet he becomes an equipped vessel for distributing mercy to the souls. This is the discussion of Madhurya Kandambini. So in this way, it becomes an interesting. The reason I'm bringing this point up is that the spiritual master can be said in the Siddha. He's totally equipped, and actually, perhaps more so than Krishna himself. And Krishna's own entourage for showing compassion towards the conditioned souls. And that way we should not lose faith in our spiritual masters, as oftentimes is somewhat, there's influence to kind of bring us into the realm of doubts in the matter. And it also helps us understand that that compassion requires also this contrasting experience. It doesn't require that, but you become most fit to really be an emissary of compassion by such a contrasting experience. Like that. So it's good information to be continued, investigation. Any other points, questions, comments? Yeah. We're on verse 9, by the way, so for tomorrow.
Just wanted to clarify my understanding of this point, see if I got it right. So the idea is basically that as conditioned souls, we've turned away from God, and the mercy of the pure devotee descends in our life in such a way that it forces us to turn towards God. So at every moment of our life or every day, the more we can turn towards Krishna, that's the mercy of the devotee flowing into our life. That's what's actually that endeavor on our part. That's really what's making us advance.
It's a combination, right? The devotees give the first investment in the form of Shraddha, and then from there we start working, we start moving. As much as Shraddha is the cause for people's determined movement, determination in anything is based on Shraddha. So the initial investment by the devotee is Shraddha, for which we begin to move towards the Absolute with greater and greater determination as our anarthas are dissipated. So it's a combination of both. The path that the devotees give is mercy. The information, the Shastras is mercy, the holy name is mercy. All these things are mercy. And then as our Shraddha is getting deeper and deeper, and we move, our movement therefore becomes more determined. So it's a combination of both. Bhakta Nishtha, Krishna's Kripa. Yeah, like that. As doubts are dissipated by the hearing process. As I have been mentioning, where there is suspicion, there is suspension. So doubts make it hard for movement in bhakti. So as you hear, and doubts are removed, then naturally. Anything else? Yeah, Acharya Nishtha Guru.
Just thinking, by light of Krishna's omniscience, can't he know the experience of anyone? Sometimes the example we give is the difference between the soul and the super soul, you can know what's going on in your own body. The super soul knows what's going on in everyone's body. So he has information of probably the physical experience as well as I could imagine the subtle body, what's going on there. He knows what's in our mind. So because he's all-knowing, I mean, he knows everything. He can know.
There's a beautiful discussion about this in the Raga Vartma Chandrika Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the relationship between Krishna's omniscience and his sweetness, his quality of sweetness. Anyway, in answer to your question, Krishna is directly aware of us through the Paramatma. And Krishna is also indirectly aware of us through the Paramatma. Because see, the Paramatma is actually directly aware of all the activities of the conditioned souls, although he's aloof. Right? That's what his description in chapter 9 Bhagavad Gita. Very beautiful description is there. And then Krishna, Swayam Rup Krishna, because he is preoccupied, in the spiritual world with the gopis and the gopas, that he's indirectly aware of the activities of conditioned souls also through Paramatma. Because Paramatma is his personal expansion. And therefore Krishna will say in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, by a fragment of myself, I am maintaining the whole show in the material world. So he need not be directly aware of it because he's indirectly aware of it through Paramatma, who's taking care of everything. And that way Krishna has the mental space to just have fun, so to speak. At the same time, in the Ravartma Chandrika, the discussion comes up that, well, who hears the prayers of the Raghunuga Bhaktas? The Ravartma Chandrika is a dissertation about Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti, given by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So he mentions this point, well, who hears the prayers if Krishna is preoccupied in the spiritual world, so he's not really knowing? So who hears the prayers of the Raghunuga Sadhakas? And the answer is ultimately Krishna hears those prayers because he's omniscient. So he can hear them and simultaneously be absorbed in sweet passion. It's a more detailed discussion than I'm going to entertain right now. But in that case, as is mentioned by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Tahara Pratana Shune Sri Nanda Kumar Shan Anga Sharanagati, something, I forget, that Sri Nanda Kumar, Krishna Braja, he hears Shune Sri Nanda Kumar, so he hears the prayers of those who are surrendered to him in the sixfold way, Shan Anga Sharanagati. So Sharanagati, as you know, has these six aspects. And so those who are surrendering to Krishna, in terms of those six aspects, increasing their surrender, progressive surrender, then Sri Nanda Kumar hears their prayers. So this is, in other words, that there would be no reason to say that statement if it was to be taken that Krishna hears everyone's prayers exactly. He hears the prayers of the Sharanagatas, those who surrender to him. So the point still remains that Krishna himself is rather preoccupied, and his involvement with the material energy is only indirect through his various potencies and through his personal expansions. But Krishna and his Swarup, his original Swarup, Swayam Rup, is preoccupied. And the beautiful thing about this understanding, sometimes a devotee asks me, well, how do I not get discouraged hearing this? I say, rather, you should be encouraged. Because the beautiful element about this understanding is that because Krishna is so aloof from the living entities, we are forced to become a part of his world rather than he becoming a part of ours. Because in other forms of theism, God is so aware of us that we can still remain the center of our own consciousness. Because God really is aware of us. But when we see that God is not so much aware as such directly, he's rather unconcerned, then in order to get Krishna's attention, we have to kind of become displaced from our own consciousness. In other words, as we become more and more intense about getting Krishna, we actually get removed out of the center of our own consciousness. Just like a boy who's trying to get the popular girl, right? Some of us may have this experience, or at least have the experience of being attracted to a popular girl, but she's so aloof from you, she doesn't even know you exist. So in order to get her attention, then you're always contemplating her and how to get her attention. And so you become almost displaced from the center of your own consciousness as such, which is not fully true. Anyway, as such, for the analogy. And then she becomes the center of your consciousness. How to get her attention, what do I have to do to get her attention, and so on. And then you would do everything to become a part of her world, as opposed to she becoming part of yours. So the beautiful thing about hearing about Krishna's aloofness from us is that we're really forced to become Krishna conscious and really become displaced from the own center of our own consciousness and become a part of Krishna's world. So then I find this conception encouraging in the sense that we really do have to become Krishna conscious. It really is true. As opposed to just, you know, toying the party line with the rudimentary program and still remain the center of our own world and not actually becoming Krishna conscious. That's okay if you want to do that. Krishna's aloof. He's not like tripping about that. Okay, you want to do something? Okay, go for it, you know. He's rather aloof. Like the space in this room is an analogy Krishna gives. Just like the space where so many living entities are depending on the space in the room right now. But the space in this room is unconcerned with our activities, right? That's because it's unconscious, of course. But in the case of Krishna, he's actually conscious and he's unconcerned. So Krishna gives that analogy to explain his relationship to this existence. So I find this concept rather exquisite, that we really have to become part of Krishna's world instead of here part of ours. Therefore, you find Richard Dawkins, he says with such disgust, you know, I really appreciate his sincerity, but he says with such disgust, why will God care who you're sleeping with? You know, he gets really, really into that. You know, he said, it's so petty. And I appreciate that point. God being so concerned about what we're doing here in the material world seems very petty. That was his point. Again, God is not unconcerned, so he descends as avatars repeatedly, and he gives facility in the form of shastras and so on. But he's very aloof, whether you want to follow that or not. He's like, oh, you are not going to follow me, you go to hell. And it's not like that. He's rather unconcerned. Here's some information, and you can take advantage of it and go up. And if you don't want, you can go to hell or heaven or the material world, and he's rather aloof. So the hero of Krishna's aloofness really should inspire in the heart the desire to become more Krishna conscious, become more part of Krishna's world. Yeah.
More than we want to come back. I've heard that said too.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to have a discussion of how to reconcile these various contradictory statements. I mean, one part of that is that in order to help us be convinced, generally we won't feel inspired just to hear about how Krishna's enjoying. Rather, we get somewhat envious. Krishna is enjoying with the gopis 24 hours a day. What? But what about all this suffering going in the material world? So then we have to hear Krishna's very concerned about us and our suffering. Okay, good. And then we feel some relief from the understanding that, okay, I can believe in such a God. In other words, to hear about a God who's just enjoying when we're very neophyte tends to augment the envious spirit towards God more than it does give appreciation. You know, here I am suffering the material world, and God is playing leapfrog with his friends in the spiritual world. Isn't he concerned about us? Now, if they were to tell us flat out, nah, we might feel somewhat discouraged. So we may hear, Krishna is God. And again, it's not that he's unconcerned. He's concerned through his devotees. In other words, we have to understand that devotees are constituents of the absolute truth. They're, you know, when we say Krishna, it's not just Krishna alone, but it's Krishna with his constituents, aspects of his... So the devotee is an aspect of his personality. So through the bhakta, Krishna is concerned for us, and more concerned for us to come back to the spiritual world than we are for ourselves. If we can understand that the devotees are actually aspects of Krishna's personality, then through that aspect... So this is obviously a glorification of Vaishnavas. Through that aspect of his personality, he is certainly more concerned for us then we are concerned for ourselves. So in that way, we can reconcile these types of statements. All right, it's already 8:40, so I thought you all were
liking the last little discussion. Krishna doesn't care about us at all. Of course, I'm just expressing that way for fun. It's not exactly like that. Like, okay, well, what is this? Final statement, yeah.
I asked Parma Karunaprabhu this question. After you presented this idea, I was asking him, like, so it says like this in Bhakti Sandarbha, how do we understand this, you know, that Krishna doesn't care about us? And Parma Karuna's answer was, when we give up envy towards others, we'll understand.
Yes. When we give up envy towards Krishna. Yeah, again, the point is that by this understanding, we really see the need to become Krishna conscious. Krishna is like the popular girl, so to speak, or the popular guy that we can't get. So we really have to become a part of his world. You know, and in order to get his attention, you require something very exquisite. Just like the boy, in order to get the popular girl's attention, he might do something really stupid. Like during the lunchtime, go and start singing on top of the table or something, you know. So she would, you know, something to get her attention. But Krishna's very unconcerned about us. So for Krishna, the only thing that attracts his attention is bhakti, pure devotion to himself. So in this way, Krishna tells us in the ninth chapter to become his devotee. Then you can get my attention, if that's what you want. Okay. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.